Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your callers from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls until we ask for them because we have a fascinating guest this evening. His name is Dr. John Martin, and he's a world-famous virologist and retrovirologist. I've known him for some years, and we've interviewed him in the past. I've been writing my newsletters. Those of you who get my regular newsletter will remember that in the June newsletter we told you the amazing story of the Salk and the Sabin vaccine. The Sabin vaccine was an activated vaccine, a killed vaccine. The Sabin Salk was killed. The Sabin vaccine was an attenuated virus. And back at about 1955, they rushed the Salk vaccine onto the market. But when Dr. Bernice Eddy, who worked at that time at the NIH, was checking the cultures, the vaccine, to make sure it was safe, she found that the Qatar vaccine had live virus in it. She told the officials of the NIH about it, and instead, of course, pulling that batch off the market, they gave it out anyway. It resulted in 200 cases of polio and about 150 paralytic polio, and I think 11 people died. Well, that created quite a furor. And, of course, how do you explain doing something that incompetent? Everybody tried to cover for themselves. Several people lost their jobs. But then about 5 years later, Dr. Eddy checked the cultures that were being used at that time to grow the polio vaccine, and she found a SV40, a cancer-producing virus in the vaccine. And, of course, when that was announced, created another furor, but they pretty well concealed that from the American people, and Dr. Eddy was demoted back at the NIH for daring to have found this cancer-producing virus, the SV40. Well, we're going to continue with this story this evening with a man who's been on the front lines of the battle about the polio vaccine and the other viruses in the polio vaccine for many years. Dr. Martin, thank you so very much for being with us.
Yeah, good evening, Stan.
Well, now, you actually worked, why don't you sort of pick up the story, because you know the story better than most people. You've been on the front lines of this already for many years.
Well, I came in to work at the Food and Drug Administration Bureau of Biologics in 1975, so that's 20 years after the vaccines were introduced. But the responsibility I had was to double check that there might not be cancer-causing agents in vaccines. I was relatively young then and sort of took it upon myself to do experiments. There was an interesting concern that came to light because by using electron microscopy, some investigators were looking at what they thought might be retroviruses in the vaccines. So we brought the vaccines to look at them. One of the tests we thought about was simply to look for the RNA of a retrovirus. What we found was this very surprising amount of DNA. Again, like most people in the public, you think that the vaccines are pure, as it were, but in fact, they're made from cells, and a lot of the products from the cells are released into the vaccine lot. What was disappointing was that when I tried to identify the DNA, a lot of it came from the cells that were used to produce the vaccine, monkey kidney cells. But there was always this amount of DNA that we couldn't account for. And in broaching that subject with the people, supervisors and so forth, again, it was sort of somewhat dismissed. Don't worry about it. Every time you have an apple, you get foreign DNA and so forth. And so that whole project was shelved at that time really discouraged, and I became aware again some years after that, that the same people who were telling me not to pursue that had embarked on a study back in 1972, before I ever started working there. And this was an appropriate study. It was somewhat later than it should have been done, but they basically set aside monkeys which were going to be used to make polio vaccines. Typically, they take the kidney tissue out from such monkeys, grow it in test tubes, add the polio virus, allow the polio virus, vaccine virus, to grow, and then harvest this material and make the vaccine from that material. So they had these 12 monkeys set aside and were relieved that there was no bad virus, Marburg virus, which they thought might have been there. There were no retroviruses, but all of the cultures grew out a type of herpes virus called monkey cytomegalovirus. What was interesting is even with their existing techniques that they were had in place, four of those isolates would have come up, but the other eight would have been missed. So here was a real good indication that there was a potential contaminant in the live polio vaccines, and the response to that was to basically let it slip by.
Now, there's basically, was this something that all the monkeys had? In other words, it just they carry this virus, part of their makeup?
Yeah, basically, they're infected by it, but all the monkeys used to make polio vaccine at the time had been infected with this type of herpes virus called cytomegalovirus. But the way I became aware of it was from the document that industry had prepared as their contingency plan. What would they do now that this information was out? What impact would it have? And as is sort of somewhat typical, it goes through all the economic reasons why they need to stay in production. But the real bottom line was that FDA would not be willing or game to take us off the market. They couldn't, and basically wouldn't do that. And I had that sort of, you know, disappointment to see government being bullied, if you want, by industry, but went back some years later to the same people who were involved in that decision-making and said, gee, why didn't you let the public know about it?
In other words, basically what this was a monkey cytomegalic or herpes virus that was in all of the monkeys, and those monkeys then were used to create the polio virus. This was the Sabin virus. Now, of course, we're assured that some of these viruses are inactivated in the human intestine when you take it orally. Would that be the case?
That was a game. One of the in that contingency plan, there was all these sort of possible reasons. And since the polio vaccine was being given by mouth, there was an argument, well, as somebody swallowed it, the stomach might destroy it. But the big argument that industry presented was, look, we've got such a long history of using this vaccine. We don't see any acute illnesses occurring. Therefore, this cannot be a problem. And that line of reasoning was acceptable if one assumes that viruses can only cause acute diseases.
Well, now, what year was this report actually prepared that you're speaking of?
1972.
All right, this was 1972, so this was actually 3 years before you went to work for FDA.
Well, and I guess we found the DNA that we couldn't explain in the vaccines in 1977, 1978, and the same people who basically said stop working on it were people who had participated in that cytomegaloviral study back in 72.
All right, so they knew it was in there, and actually there was a lot of money at stake in this. There's big money to be made in polio vaccine, and so they figured, well, since nobody's died yet, we're just not going to worry about it, or at least we don't know of anybody who's died yet.
Yeah, and the other restriction, they came back and said that the information that they obtain in any of the products that the government regulates or FDA was regulating at the time, all of that information is protected by the proprietary interest of industry, and they were not able to provide that information to the medical community, the scientific public, because it would disclose something about the manufacturing process and so forth.
But, the big thing was they didn't want the public to know that here was another virus that was in. We had the SV40 that had been in the Salk vaccine, and we had the live poliovirus in the Qatar vaccine. The last thing they wanted was the American people to know that there might be another monkey contaminant there?
Well, I think it's a balancing act. On the one hand, they want, as they should, to have people compliant with taking vaccines to get the benefit of vaccines, but that excuse tends to suppress each and every report that might discourage the use of vaccines. The obvious approach is to accept the information, evaluate it, make the necessary changes, and move on.
In other words, basically, it's sort of an elitist attitude. We make the decisions for the common folks because they aren't capable of making decisions. They're not as smart or well-oriented, or they're not scientists like we are.
No, I think it's worse than that. I think it's that we cannot discuss this information with our scientific colleagues because we will be criticized for by industry for sort of using what they will insist is proprietary information.
All right,
so fine. That's basically, I think, the protection. And I know that because I had the chance to go to Congress, and again, naively walking in and enjoying meeting people at relatively low levels in the Congress. There's a Commerce Committee in the Senate, in the House, could talk to the counsel for the House Commerce Committee and just suggest, why not put a sentence in the next FDA reform bill that if a safety issue is identified in the regulation of a biological product, then industry will agree to waive its proprietary interest so that that information can be made public, or at least communicated to the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
And I was said it was a great idea, tasked to get some support for it. One person I contacted was the American Medical Association lobbyist in Washington and said, would you support this? And literally the response came back, no, then the public would lose confidence in the doctors if they realized that doctors were not in the knowledge loop.
All right, and I think that's the big thing, and I think the average doctor does the best he can, but if he's not told, and if there is an organized effort on the part of manufacturers and agencies not to tell him, then he simply goes along with what he learns at meetings or he reads in the publications, and he's giving these vaccines without even a thought that there might be something there that might be harmful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he can't be criticized for not knowing or not being told of the complexities of vaccines, and that's where the elitist attitude does come in, to say that the regulatory agencies have to nurture their own set of consultants, and only they will be wise enough to pass an opinion, as opposed to the everyday scientist who has an opinion. I know years ago when I found, as we'll get on to, this cytomegalovirus or derivatives of this cytomegalovirus in some of the patients we were dealing with, I would go to heads of microbiology departments, Stanford University and other places, and they would be aghast to think that they were still making polio vaccines in kidney cells from monkeys. I mean, it seemed like, again, an unwillingness to really give details the way vaccines are made, the way they're being tested, evaluated, and an open consideration of all the potential complications that could come from vaccines.
All right, so eventually you left the FDA. I understand the supervisor, the man that you'd been dealing with when you were at the FDA, who told you not to worry about it, didn't he quit and go to work for American Home Products?
Yeah, I mean, I think people know this revolving door, but he certainly did become a vice president in the same company that was making vaccines, and I think that's part of the kind of nurturing that they provide each other. And again, it just puts the regulatory industry somewhat in a pro regulatory agencies in a kind of a pro-industry type position. But you're right. Now, he went to work there. Again, I think that they're not making the decision at the time knowing that they're going to do harm to the public. I think it's more that the inclination is not to change status quo. Inclination is not to bring up topics that there's not an immediate answer for. It's easier to suppress it, let it slip by, than address it, and then it's forgotten about. And so again, it was that whole information about those 12 monkeys being tested for the cytomegalovirus was not widely understood, known among people at FDA, and they were surprised when I would go back with these documents and say, look at this. And again, a real division. Anybody working at low, middle level, if you want, in FDA are highly committed to doing their job well and having a high-quality product. It's only when you get to the top where you see a compromise coming in and a tendency, again, to let the system roll on, not be altogether accountable.
All right, and Chris, if you rock the boat, why, you know, very often you don't get ahead, you don't get promoted. So there is certainly a vested self-interest in going along with the system, which is why we're seeing so many people, you know, in our major corporations today. All these people knew something was wrong, but they didn't necessarily want to speak out. After all, you know, the good times were rolling, and now we find that this corruption and false accounting permeates almost all of our major corporations, and now they're all beginning to crumble. Well, so you found that you knew the DNA was there, and then eventually you found the original records. How did you get hold of those records? Did you get them from the manufacturer? How did you get the records of the original investigation in 1972?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and again, that's one reason why I stick with what we're doing. It's sad to see people know of problems and not have an opportunity to express it, which again is why I appreciate your programs and people like yourself who are willing to get out there. So an individual feeling guilty about a lot of what he knew went on, vaccines and so forth, came to me to say, look, this might help you. Here's some information I've stashed away. This is a memo from industry. This is a memo from the government. This is there. So that was kind of responsibility thrust on my shoulders. I was happy to take it back to FDA and say, look, this is what you all did then. Why did you do it? And as I said, honestly thought that I could help the agency by going to Congress and asking them to do what they might. I can follow that same story up, that AMA was not supportive. And since then, I've had an apology from the more recent president of AMA, but still, it came a little bit late. What was interesting to me was the counsel from the Commerce Committee went to FDA to ask them if they were in favor of this modification in the bill, and he came back and told me, no, they were against it. And I said, how is that? And essentially, to paraphrase what he was saying, is that people who are in high-level industry are recruited by industry in the sense that they have all this internal information, and they did not want to be compromised in the sense of being, to quote him, a sieve of all this interesting information. So they basically wanted to protect the idea that they could hold close to them any information they had about products from one company or another, because that enhanced their ability to act as consultants and work in industry and so forth.
But of course, the thing is, the vaccine manufacturers have got Congress to pass legislation so that, they can't be sued. There is a federal fund so that if you're harmed by a vaccine, you can bring suit there. But of course, if you can't get the information from the drug companies, in other words, they're able to keep information secret, you've deprived people of one of their best means of winning a suit against the government.
There's no question. I came across that, I guess, back in 1995. There was a child who had an unusual illness, and the mother withstood all the pressure upon her to not be focusing on polio vaccine and so forth. And she, as I said, withstood a lot of threats and intimidation and selling out, to the extent that even with her husband, he was on one side wanting to say, look, let's take the money. And she was pretty concerned. And she went ahead with her support to get a judge in the case to identify the lot of polio vaccine that this child had and was going to give permission to test it for HIV. This was what was being considered at the time. What was interesting was that the judge was so adamant that there'd be no other test performed at all, not tests for monkey immune deficiency virus, certainly not tests for cytomegalovirus. And the government took the same position, supportive of very, very restricted, limited testing on this batch of polio vaccine. So the individuals came to me to ask if I'd be willing to test the child for one of the cytomegalovirus-derived viruses in the child, feeling that if we could show that the child was infected with one of these cytomegaloviruses, that could go back to the judge to ask for permission to test that vaccine for these cytomegaloviruses. And we never were able to carry that through. Again, once people started to hear about that line of reasoning, that brought further restrictions.
Now, of course, did this child have HIV, or was it
Well, very frankly, he had a strange virus, and I could culture in his laboratory what I am basically calling stealth-adapted viruses, some of which undoubtedly, irrefutably coming from monkey cytomegaloviruses, but the process probably is generic to other viruses. But this particular child had a strange, atypical, stealth-adapted virus, but it was not possible back in 96 to continue this. But he had that, and then the child went on and developed a brain lesion. Again, interestingly, because it ought to have been pursued. They did the biopsy. There was a lot of confusion among the pathologists, whether it was a tumor, a viral infection, a fungal infection. It had very unusual features. When I did get a chance to look at that biopsy, it had all the hallmarks of one of these stealth-adapted viruses. So my feeling about that child is whatever else he was infected with, he was infected with a stealth-type virus, and if we had the resources at the time, we probably could have pursued it to ask definitively whether it had come from the polio vaccine.
Well, now, of course, you call these stealth viruses, you also call them poliomyeviruses, and these are very specific. This is cytomegalic virus. Could you explain to our listeners what a cytomegalic virus is, sort of in terms that the average layman might
understand? Oh, no, absolutely, sure. There are small viruses and there are big viruses, and cytomegalovirus is one of the biggest that's known to infect humans. And if we looked at its genome, the way it's made up of its DNA pieces, there's over 200,000 nucleotides strung together in a long, long genome of this virus. Now, it codes for many components, and it's, as it were, close to 200 different components. What's interesting is that our immune system really targets only three of those components to any significant extent. What this means is that you can have a virus with 200 or more components, if it manages to lose, delete, get rid of two or three of these critical components, our immune system won't effectively recognize it, engage it, and it will infect somebody but not evoke an inflammatory reaction. So one of the first bits of research we came across was the fact that we had patients who would have brain illnesses particularly, and the nature of the illness would not be understood. Occasionally, these patients would have biopsies taken of their brain to try to check if it was a cancer or some other strange process, and they would not think about infection because there was no inflammation. There was no pus forming in the brain. It didn't look like an infection. And what was not recognized at the time is that you can, in fact, have stealth-adapted viruses that can damage cells but cannot evoke this inflammatory reaction.
And so ordinarily that you'd look at the slide and you'd see either the white cells, the polymorphonuclear leukocytes, or the lymphocytes surrounding the virus trying to wall it off. And in this case, there's no inflammatory response.
Absolutely. And we've seen those cases now repeatedly. Back in 1990, the first lady had a brain biopsy. We had a boy a couple of years ago who had brain biopsies both in Las Vegas when he was first referred. The parents took the child to Johns Hopkins, Scripps Clinic, Stanford. Stanford neurosurgeons did another brain biopsy. But even though this tissue was sent to NIH, sent to major neuropathology centers, the pathologists are not yet accustomed to the idea that you can have a viral infection and no inflammation.
And this actually will get into the spinal cord as well as the brain and produce progressive neurological changes?
Oh, absolutely. And now, I mean, the work is associating the stealth-adapted viruses with a whole slew of neurodegenerative-type conditions and such common conditions as depression, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia. Many of the illnesses that are increasing in our society, we can identify in those patients evidence for having a stealth virus infection. And again, in retrospect, it goes back to kind of the tragedy that what could have been identified as a potential problem back in 1972 has taken all this long to even get the concept out there that some of these viruses that have certainly come from vaccines are able to cause illness and are now unable to be resisted by our immune systems.
And of course, what about 10% of the population that are infected with these viruses?
When we've looked at students in a university campus here in Southern California, 10% of the people well enough to want to give blood for transfusion, when a blood sample was provided to us with informed consent and so forth, 10% of those samples tested positive. And again, what is tragic is there's no restriction of those blood samples going into the blood supply. We don't know of those 10% how many might have symptoms, but what I can tell you, and the reason we don't know that is everything was done blindly, but if I inquire of the blood bank, some of the people list in their medications, Celexa and other antidepressants. So it's clear that some people who are still giving blood will have symptoms of, say, depression, and yet it's not going to be recognized, and unless the word gets out, won't be recognized that if you are depressed, if you do have these chronic fatiguing-type illnesses, you might well be infected, and certainly it doesn't seem a good idea to be using blood from people with those symptoms going into the blood supply.
And of course, there's so many other things that are made from this, you know, the cryoprecipitate, and, certainly when you're a physician, why you're using the clotting factor, and you're using white cells or platelets, and yet Of course, these are all pooled, and so if there's one lot that has the cytomegalic virus in it, why, you can give it to really dozens, if not hundreds, of patients. So that's the real problem with these things. We're going to have to take a quick break here. When we get back, I really want to get back into some of the testimony you've given before congressional committees, and, of course, what the response was, and then, of course, your view on why we've changed the whole pattern of giving the polio vaccine to patients here starting a couple of years ago. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there across America listening to us, or even here in the Central Coast of California, we hope that many of you will really want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day, trying to bring people the news behind the news, the story behind the story, trying to let you understand that, you know, you're responsible for your health, you're responsible for your family's health, and you can't either trust the manufacturers or necessarily the drug companies. And something wonderful, wonderful things have been accomplished with medicine, but some terrible things have been accomplished too. And the trouble is that we're not getting the truth. And so at least we have a small voice, but that voice is growing across America with the help of people who believe in what we're doing and help us as we reach out to other stations. And, of course, we buy time on stations. That's how we're able to get the information out. I should mention, if you're living up in the Northwest, we are going to be doing a program in the American Christian Network tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. So if you are available, listen to any of the ACN stations up there. There are 5 of them, and certainly they cover the Great Northwest very well. We're grateful to have the opportunity to be there, and it'll be heard back in New York State as well, and hopefully before long on stations across America. But all of these things that we do, of course, we require your help on. We certainly need your help. We also, of course, do another program on Saturdays that's pre-recorded that's about gets to 15 stations. But tomorrow morning's program will be a live program, and we'll be doing a regular live program there on the American Christian Network. So please tell others and listen in. I think you'll find it a fascinating, fascinating program. But we hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will consider seriously joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, of course, this one actually deals with the original polio vaccine that was put out, the presence of SV40 in that vaccine that has been kept from the American people for many years. And give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war. America is, in many respects, under attack today. Again, the number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin is a retrovirologist. He has both an MD and a PhD, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, fine. And, of course, now let's talk a little bit about fact, maybe we'll get to the congressional testimony before long, but, you know, for years, why doctors were told, now you're only to give the Sabin vaccine, and for the listeners out there, the Sabin vaccine was an attenuated, a weakened vaccine, but it was still a live vaccine. And then back about 1970, 1985, why doctors were told, well, you give 2 doses of the Salk vaccine, which is the dead vaccine, and 2 doses of Sabin vaccine, because we're worried that the Sabin vaccine may go wild. We had 8 cases of it in America last year. In other words, it becomes virulent and can infect parents or others. And then, of course, in the year 2000, suddenly, after all these years of using the Sabin vaccine, why CDC came out and said, we won't use Sabin anymore, we'll just use the killed vaccine. But it's because we're here to help you. We're concerned about the virus going wild in the Sabin. Is that the reason that they changed over, or are they concerned about these monkey viruses, do you think? Do we have any way of knowing?
Well, I'm not certain, Stan. I mean, have a sense that experts do everything they can to maintain their position as experts, therefore are very reluctant to give an indication that they might have overlooked something or been slow to respond. I know, having found these atypical viruses, stealth-adapted viruses, and having shown that some of them at least had come from the cytomegaloviruses of the monkeys used to make vaccines, I was posed the question, would formaldehyde, which is used to make the salt vaccine, to inactivate it, would formaldehyde destroy one of these stealth viruses? And of course my answer was, I don't know. But it was an issue that was raised. I then had a discussion with the chairman of the National Vaccine Advisory Committee and so forth, who again, people were very uncomfortable with the live vaccine for a variety of reasons, not only by finding this stealth virus, but it's a pretty crude way of making it. So he again confided that it would be smart to switch, but as he said to me, let's do it slowly so as to give industry a chance to build up their stocks and make the adjustments and so forth.
Well, you also have a terrible, terrible feeling that maybe you want to get rid of the old vaccine because it cost something to make it, and if they simply switched over and left these people with all that salt vaccine on hand, that's the attenuated virus, why, there'd be some pretty unhappy manufacturing companies, wouldn't there?
Well, I think even in the very early days of polio vaccine, when it was first being made, and as you said, because of the Qatar incident and other reasons, people were becoming somewhat suspect with the inactivation process used for vaccine. It was argued that the reason vaccination became mandatory was under the influence of industry wanting to get rid of the warehouse stocks of material. So I'm sure those considerations come in. What I was more disappointed with was the inference that those people who knew about this would, of course, switch to the salt vaccine, the inactivated vaccine, and let the public sort of only slowly catch on. So it wasn't really as forthright as one would like. It was also made complicated because the World Health Organization is concerned, as it should be, in eradicating polio from around the world, and yet the cost factor for salt was far greater than Sabin vaccines. But they had to, as it were, have that double standard. So still the WHO, in their polio vaccine eradication programs, are using the live viral vaccines made in African green monkeys, and they haven't had the ability to switch, as this country has now, to complete use of
the stock vaccine, right.
And again, it's unfortunate that economics and politics and so forth all fit into these decisions, and you can't get a clean scientific decision made and then make the political adjustments. Rather, the political considerations and economic considerations tend to dominate most of the scientific discussion.
Well, now, are they still making the salk vaccine? Are they growing it in the cultures of the kidney of the green monkey? Is this still how they make the polio vaccine?
There's two approaches. That one, but that's the major one that's used, but the switch is has occurred with some of the companies. And again, most of this information is not public because it's proprietary, but they realize that you can take established cell lines that are not fresh kidneys. What happened way back when they first started the polio program was an enormous concern that people might not take a vaccine if they thought it could cause cancer. So that was my task in somewhat with the FDA. So the concern was, let's make sure that the cells that we're making the polio vaccine in are as close to normal as we can. Let's go to fresh tissues from a monkey, and then these cells are clearly not malignant. We're taking a normal kidney. Whereas people had argued at the time that it would be safer to establish a cell line, do a thorough analysis of that cell line, make sure it had absolutely no viruses and so forth, and that continuous cell line could be used by everybody with assurance. The concern was possibly that cell line had taken a step towards becoming malignant, let's not use it. And again, it's interesting to look back and to appreciate the scientific reasoning that goes into these decisions. What's disappointing is once the decisions are made, they're not readdressed as more information becomes available. The concerns, early concerns about cancer causing, vaccines causing cancer soon gave away. And now we make a lot of monoclonal antibodies in tumor cell lines. We have a much better understanding of it. But still, the reaction was, no, let's stick with tissues from monkeys, even though it was known at the time that these monkeys probably had a number of infectious agents.
And I think, you know, this is the amazing thing, that they took a chance on infecting the whole human race with these monkey viruses because they wanted to, of course, address the polio problem.
Sure. And I think, again, looking back on it, and as you said, it's been interesting to read it, it was the rush to make the change and the idea of providing a false reassurance to the public that everything that could be done was done. I think that if one had one's chances all over again, there would have been a much more vigorous discussion, debate, switching from rhesus monkeys, which had the SV40 contaminant, to African green monkey, to sort of basically take a long, hard look at making that switch. And it wouldn't, the switch was made in about 1960, 61. It wasn't to 72 that they did this study. If prudence would have said they should have done those sorts of studies much earlier, and then it would have been easier to have responded to finding cytomegaloviruses. By delaying it until 72, having committed large numbers of people to having had this vaccine, it was politically difficult to then come out and openly state that, my God, we've probably infected you with yet another virus.
Well, could we just briefly touch on the SV40? Because a lot of people don't know that incredible, incredible story. SV40 was the 40th simian virus that the investigators found. They found other monkey viruses, but none of them appeared to be very pathological. But they found SV40, which you injected into hamsters, and it produced both mesotheliomas and brain tumors. Well, of course, they're finding this in the cultures that they're growing the polio vaccine. It's in polio vaccine. So what happened to that? Do you remember the rest of the story?
No, absolutely. In fact, I once said to myself, I'll be happy when a photograph of Bernice Eddy is put up prominently at NIH. Cause she, as you said, represents the type of person you want to see in government. She was instrumental in the early days to realize that the inactivation process that Dr. Salk had first advocated wasn't complete, and there were escapes, as with the Qatar vaccines and, in fact, other vaccines. But she continued the work, and she was working with a virus called poliomavirus that induced tumors in mice, and she found a similar virus in the polio vaccines. She was really suppressed with providing that information to the public. She gallantly went to a meeting at New York, let it be known that she was finding these viruses. And it was really just the fact that one of the major commercial company scientists from one of the major pharmaceutical houses had heard of what she was doing, basically confirmed the work, and that he and his colleague defined the virus as SV40, simian virus number 40. But Bernice Eddy was the first lady to do it. Having announced it at this meeting, she was roundly criticized, and when she took evidence for the tumors to her supervisors, they all dismissed it. So that was a concern with SV40. Again, there was a lot of early reaction, my God, this could be awful. Fortunately, nothing acutely occurred, but there have been investigators interested in SV40 in certain tumors, mesotheliomas, brain tumors. I happen to have, again, from one of these generous people who are out there, hidden, as it were, from, or suppressed from public view and discourse, who brought me a vial of vaccine made back in 1955.
Oh, boy, and that's invaluable.
Yeah, and this was fantastic. And so I immediately looked at it for SV40, and it was there. It was clear. We had it. We didn't have the facility in the lab, since I had to close one lab to open up this other one to do the sequence. But what I was able to do is find evidence for SV40, and I thought, what a great example if I could show using this what's called a polymerase chain reaction, PCR technique, if I could show a positive SV40, I could make the case, not to blame people because I didn't have this technique available early, but now that we do have PCR assays, surely we should look for monkey cytomegaloviruses using this assay. But I had this vaccine and I provided it to Dr. Boutel in Texas and Dr. Carbone in Illinois, now University of Chicago, within the University of Chicago. And he kept on saying, can you give me more, more, more? So I was providing it to him. Told him who we had it from, a very nice gentleman, Dr. Ratner.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Well, so. He was back in Chicago, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah. And he was one of the people who spoke out against the vaccine. Anyhow, it was somewhat disappointing, as happens in science, that finally the work was published, but it was twisted around and it wasn't presented in the way that I wanted to have it presented, which was in the public health sense of saying, look, we should be using this technology. And Dr. Carbone went ahead and published a paper, and it's somewhat disappointing to myself because it didn't achieve the public health goal that I thought it should, and twisted by sort of somewhat saying, well, the work was subsequently confirmed with batches kind of subsequently received from John Martin. But I think the point is that we need to encourage government to be more proactive with using modern techniques to assure the public about the safety of products.
Well, I think that what's significant is the fact that it was 1961 and 1962 that they changed over from using the rhesus monkey, which had the SV40, which was a cancer-producing virus in it, to green monkeys. It was a decade later before they tested the green monkeys, and they found that they had this cytomegalic virus in it that they'd been giving to people, but they suppressed that information, and it's still being suppressed to this day.
Yeah, well, what was, I mean, even 1996, as it were, I would go to a meeting and talk, not to the bosses, but to the people making the vaccine, and after the frosty introduction, they're saying, look, we're all parents. We have children. You have your children. I have my children. We're concerned. Tell me, do you still see cytomegaloviruses in some of your vaccine lots? And the answer came back specifically, not infrequently. Now, when they see it, they were not submitting those vaccine lots to FDA, but their sensitivity was fairly crude. They obviously could be missing some. So I felt very justified having just heard this. Nice people involved in vaccine making tell me not infrequently they have this contaminant, to go straight back to FDA and say, look, please use your molecular techniques, PCR assays and so forth. You've got to do this because this virus probably is still in some of these vaccines that are slipping through you. And to get back the answer, John, we wouldn't know what to do if we have a positive result, is the kind of disappointment that one doesn't want to hear. In other words, we shouldn't be limited by what the people can do, not do, politically and scientifically in our regulatory agencies.
But, of course, the tragedy is that the American people don't know this. The American people put their blind faith in these government officials and, you know, and in their doctor, and not that the doctor is in any way responsible, but that's why I do a program like this. If you're out there in the listening audience, you've got to understand that government officials cannot do what they'd like to do, or they're going to lose their job. And that's really what the name of the game is. Get through, get your pension, get retired, and too bad if, you know, there's nothing I can do, because if I take a stand, I'm going to lose my job. And that, tragically, is the situation, I believe, in so much of the government today. Would you think that's true or not?
Oh, again, it's so, I've encountered the situation, I remember once when the way polio vaccines are tested is you inoculate some of the vaccine into the spinal cord of a monkey. And the point was made that they use rhesus monkeys, not African green monkeys, because African green monkeys are too dirty. They have too many unknown viruses. But the point was that you still get significant pathology and damage, not as much as a wild-type virus, but you get damage in the animal. And so talking to a veterinarian and so forth, he was very enthusiastic, as I was, that I might have a chance to look at those spinal tissues and see for myself what kind of damage could I relate it to this. We set up an appointment for me to come back to FDA lab to look at it. When I came back, only to be told, no, he's been told it's proprietary. He can't show anything to me. I'm not allowed to see it, and so forth. Hugely disappointing.
Well, I would point out that if there's nothing to conceal, then why are they concealing it?
Well, they conceal it because it's considered proprietary information, and their bosses, as it were, are industry on the one hand, or industry-funded politicians on the other hand. It doesn't give them that ability. And as I said, when I enjoy talking it to these mid-level people, because they would love to see the system improve, but there's this kind of political ceiling over them to prevent their work getting into the open.
All right. Well, now, are we seeing more and more of these diseases as times go by? And what sort of diseases are we really talking about that are related to this, these foamy viruses, these stealth viruses?
Okay. Now, that's a very good question. I started off looking at the challenge DIO, find out what causes chronic fatigue syndrome. But our very second case that we found, a monkey cytomegalovirus, stealth-adapted monkey cytomegalovirus in, was a lady who had initially been called schizophrenic, then manic depressive illness, then she had an unexplained coma-type situation where she was brought into the Los Angeles County Hospital unconscious. And again, as in so many of these cases, they wanted to see if there might have been an encephalitis, an infection, but there was absolutely no inflammatory reaction in the fluid that bathes the brain. So that was that case. Now, I went to a recent meeting in March that CDC had sponsored, only to hear once more from our California Department of Health that on average, over 100 cases per year are being reported to the state health department from hospitals of patients with very severe neurological illnesses for which they can't find a cause. And it doesn't say that they're not virus, but it does say to me, gosh, let's work together. I know how to culture these viruses. I've been doing it for 10 years. Let's work together and see if some of these patients don't have these stealth-adapted viruses. I'm confident that many do. Once that point is established, that people can have very, very severe illnesses, brain illnesses, because of these stealth viruses, it will follow that the larger number of people, not just 100, but many thousands of people who have these chronic, fatiguing, neurodegenerative type illnesses catalyzed or cataloged by neurologists and psychiatrists into different syndromes may all have the same underlying virus. And that spills over to diseases like multiple sclerosis, which basically says you can have a viral infection complicated by an autoimmune component, to Parkinson's disease, to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, many, many severe diseases. And then if we remove ourselves away from the adult, and what I think is important is to begin to look at the children who are born with or develop autism, learning deficits, eating disorders, behavioral problems. More and more, we can culture from their blood these stealth-adapted viruses.
And you can actually culture these viruses out then and then and identify them with the PCR?
Yeah,
is that what you do?
Well, we don't do it. For resources, we don't do that much. The ones that we have and gone ahead and sequenced, the two that we really have very extensive sequence data on are no doubt downsized derivatives of cytomegalovirus.
Now, are there several cytomegalic viruses, or are they just one?
No. There's the concept now is that this stealth adaptation, this losing of the markers that our immune system would normally target for resistance, can be a generic process, and it can occur with Epstein-Barr virus, herpes simplex virus, human herpes virus 6. What really makes it interesting, Stan, is in addition to losing some of those markers, these viruses can gain additional genetic sequences, part of this compensation process so they can retain or regain their ability to cause cell damage. And what is interesting in that regard is that these viruses can pick up bacteria-derived sequences. What this is leading us to understand now that when people don't have an appreciation of these complex organisms, a bit of viral gene mixed with cellular or bacterial genes, you can get positive assays if you run a test for, say, Lyme disease, if you're from the northeast part of this country, and it will come back positive. Or you can run a test for mycoplasma or chlamydia, and those tests can come back positive, not because it's a mycoplasma, not because it's chlamydia, but because parts of the genes from mycoplasma, chlamydia, borrelia, the agent that causes Lyme disease, part of those genes can come into this stealth viral process and give you these positive results. But the indications are that many of these patients with those illnesses are in fact infected with these atypical stealth-adapted viruses.
And they mean these viruses, these stealth viruses, have actually picked up part of the genetic makeup then of the Borrelia, of the mycoplasma, the others?
Absolutely. And this, again, is enough, you know, it ought to shake CDC at its foundations and so forth. Even though the work is presented to them, the tendency is not to want to sort of start buying into it, because the immediate first conclusion is that some of these viruses came from polio vaccines.
And that's the last thing we want the American people to know. We're going to have to take a two-minute break here, and we have to say, of course, at this time, goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and we hope that many of you will be listening in tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock if you're listening to an ACN, American Christian Network station, and we'll be with you for our I guess that'll be our second program up there, but we'll be doing this every Saturday at 10 o'clock. So please, until Monday, pray for our nation and pray for our leaders. Pray that there will be a revival in America, because if the American people don't turn back to God, I'm firmly convinced God is going to turn his back on America. And then please remember to pray for our Ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we will take calls during this hour if you have a question. But right now, of course, our special guest for the evening is Dr. John Martin. And Dr. Martin is an internationally known virologist. He is a PhD and an MD. And Dr. Martin, you have a laboratory now. Have a website or a telephone number or anything you'd like to get out for our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of information on the website, www.ccid.org, or another one is www.stealthvirus.com. So the CCID refers to a Center for Complex Infectious Diseases, and it's in Rosemead, California. I prefer not to give the telephone number out, it would get swamped, but I do enjoy reviewing emails, and particularly hearing of patients who have these complex illnesses, sometimes when they run in families, and even can involve animal pets in the family. More and more we're hearing of an adult with chronic fatigue syndrome to hear that their parent, elderly parent, had an unusual case of Parkinson's or Alzheimer's and so forth, and sadly that the son or daughter is now being diagnosed with manic depression or schizophrenia. It's in that kind of a family structure that I'm very interested in getting involved, seeing, in fact, if there is an infection pervasive within the family. And we really are getting very close now to wanting to see large-scale clinical trials on how to suppress these stealth viruses.
Well, now, do you have an email address where people... And,
yeah, there is an email address. I'm trying to think, they all flood up, but the simplest one probably is ccidlab@hotmail.com.
@hotmail.com, okay.
And but the last hour was somewhat doom and gloom. I really would like to replace that sense of the painful delays in seeing the work proceed with a sense that the research is actually moving along very fast at the moment, and I'm really quite optimistic, having learned more about these viruses in the last 6 months than the last 5 years.
Please share with us. We need all the optimism we can get in days like this. So what have you learned? I know that you've dedicated your life to this study, and where do we stand now, and what about the possibility of either finding some simple means of identifying this, and then the treatment, because the treatment is what people need.
Mm-hmm. No, it's absolutely. And I think it's that one should acknowledge that people who find something out may not interpret it properly, but at least the information is out there. So I've been impressed by a lot of physicians in the alternate medicine field who haven't really proceeded along scientific basis of double-blind studies and so forth, yet have had some interesting observations. So if we don't have the immune system tackling these viruses, we have to look at other mechanisms. Now, I had a electron micrograph, a very high-powered photograph of brain tissue obtained back in 1991, early 1991, February 1991, and had it enlarged, and it's been on my wall for literally the last 10 years. Only sometime last year did I look at it, and all of a sudden realized that I was feeling sorry for that cell because it had a lot of lipid material in it, had a lot of other material that looked strange, and the reaction was, no, that cell is actually surviving. It's trying to say something in the sense that it is not dead yet. And that led me to look, one, why these cells are becoming foamy, vacuolated, to say that some of this lipid material could be helpful, could get into the mitochondria of the cells more effectively than others. So that's one of the clinical trials we're starting to design. And the second one is that the material in the cell, this energy-generating material, is really very encouraging. And what we now more or less can do is stimulate that material to the extent that we can help resuscitate the cells in culture, and the cells begin to look far better for stimulating that material. On the other hand, if we overly stimulate it, we can lead to cell death.
No, now how would you go about stimulating these cells? Would you use some sort of herbs or these other things that alternative doctors use, the echinacea or the garlic or the, what were you thinking of?
Yeah, well, both that and as well as the general field of energy medicine and sort of magnetic fields and some of the light frequencies and so forth. So I've been combining both approaches in terms of still looking down the test tube, but realizing that there were investigators. There was a Dr. Reif back in 1932, also here in Southern California, and he argued that he could kill tumor cells using an old X-ray tube that he put neon gas and argon gas into it and would make light frequencies coming activate that, and the light frequencies were able to bring about some cures of the patient. Again, his work tended to be suppressed and so forth, but if we take the observation as valid, I can now look at what we're doing and relate what we're doing to what he had done, again, back in 1930. And the real sense of optimism is that even though traditional medicine tends to stay fairly straight and narrow, if we look at these observations and say, well, how is it that he was achieving his effect? Why are some people responding to magnets? And why are some people, conditions getting worse, if you want, on a full moon night and so on and so forth? There's a lot of information to be gleaned from patients from these observations. And I think what I now understand about these stealth-adapted viruses, material I'm calling alternate cellular energy pigments, ACE pigments, then it's starting to make, to pull together to the extent of, wow, this is good stuff. It's about time, but I'm feeling particularly optimistic that we're on the right track, that it's a matter of still of having to prove it with double-blind controlled studies, but what we're focusing on now is stealth virus targeted light and electromagnetic therapy as a way of either resuscitating cells and those people who have neurodegenerative illnesses, or if we identify cancers, as we have in a number of patients, where the indications are that the cancer is a complication of a stealth viral infection, then we ought to be able to intensify that treatment to the extent of killing the cancer cells.
And as the, basically then, you mean the presence of these stealth viruses can actually lead to cancer, in other words, can cause the surrounding cells to begin to proliferate wildly without and overcome the cancer-suppressing gene that may be in them?
Yeah, and again, it's a shame that people didn't listen to this when we first started to see it, but part of the stealth adaptation process is the ability of these viruses to capture, amplify, modify cellular genes that can include genes that are associated with cancers. So more and more now, we're coming across somebody who has had a chronic fatiguing illness 10 or more years, then the breast cancer comes, the prostate cancer comes, the multiple myeloma comes, and we see their illness now as an extension of the devastation caused by these stealth-adapted viruses.
Well, do you think that these viruses actually prevent the normal immune response? Because, of course, you know, a lot of people will have a tendency towards cancer, but the immune system takes care of it very well. I can remember seeing patients riddled with cancer when I was very young, and I knew they were going to die. I mean, of course they were going to die, and they got better, you know, and it just never made any sense. It didn't happen very often, but it happened often enough to raise that question in your mind, what's happening? This is going against everything I've been taught. What you're suggesting is that then the immune system is compromised, and what you're suggesting is what we need to find some means of increasing the immune response to help the body fight the cancer?
I think it's more along the line, Stan, of not looking at cancer as an isolated illness in a patient, but rather, and it may be in some patients that way, but rather identifying those patients who have been sick for many years beforehand, particularly if there is this neurological, neuropsychiatric kind of illness. I know I did a study here with a good investigator at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, and of all his multiple myeloma patients, we took a group of 20, half of them had a previous severe neuropsychiatric illness, and that occurred several years before their multiple myeloma. It makes more sense now to link the two together, and sure enough, when we looked for these stealth-adapted viruses, all of those multiple myeloma patients had it, which means, in an optimistic way, if we can suppress the virus, we may well be able to suppress the tumor.
So basically what you're saying is that in many instances, cancer is a systemic disease, and the cancer then being a manifestation of a systemic disease.
And more specifically than that, we're finding individual patients who will specifically talk about their chronic fatigue syndrome that was there for some time, their cancer will develop, and then it turns out that their children have learning disorders, their parents have neurodegenerative type illnesses, and I think we can pull all of those, that spectrum of illnesses together and say there's an underlying virus, that virus is one of these stealth-adapted viruses. It manifests itself differently in the different patients, different syndromes and different types of illnesses, but it's the target that we need to go after.
All right, well, our telephone number is 464-8295 in the Central Coast of California, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you're here in the Central Coast, 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you're out across America. If you have a question or comment, why don't hesitate to give us a call. Our guest this evening is Dr. John Martin. He's a physician. He's a retrovirologist. He holds both a PhD and a medical degree. So, of course, he can look at these things not simply as a scientist, but as a clinician as well, which, of course, gives him a double advantage. And, you know, when you talk about multiple myeloma, very good friend, a gentleman I've known for some years, very active in the Patriot Movement, has a multiple myeloma, and, of course, you know, ordinarily you treat it with chemotherapy and radiation, and all of these things which just sort of damage the immune system. There may be a few medicines out there that help it, but this is almost a universally fatal disease. Were you able to do anything to help these people at Cedars-Sinai, or was this more or less to try to see whether or not they all carry these stealth type of viruses?
Yeah, well, again, I should go back. I mean, the first introduction I had to multiple myeloma was a lady who works as a school teacher for mentally impaired children. I knew of her, but I knew more of her son, again, 10 years ago, and I just spent a moment on his story because he was an honor student. He had a merit scholarship to a major university. Just at the end of high school, he was struck with this chronic fatigue syndrome, went into the university but had to drop out, and literally for the last 10 years has had a very unsatisfying, somewhat wasted life, barely able to function properly. The mother then, I knew she was infected with chronic fatigue. I knew she worked with these special educational need children and so forth. She was one of the people who developed a uterine cancer that had to be treated and could think about it might be a virus. Then she called one day and said her father, a physician, had multiple myeloma. He was the first case that we tested, and sure enough, he had a very striking stealth viral infection, and he responded to an antiviral treatment. But the physician who he was going to, and I won't mention his name, but the Cedars-Sinai and very prominent clinician in the field of multiple myeloma, started to treat him, and then he informed me that one of the treatments that he was exploring was a drug called Biaxin, an antibiotic, Biaxin clarithromycin. And I found that very fascinating because it was an example, again, where just because a drug is called an antibiotic doesn't mean that its only action is killing bacteria. And this drug, Biaxin, along with thalidomide, along with low-dose steroids, is now one of the major protocols that's being used successfully with multiple myeloma patients. There seems to be some kind of resistance to sort of say, well, gee, what are we doing? But it turns out that Biaxin is inhibitory to the same pathway that we know activates some of the stealth viruses, compounds called cytokines and chemokines and so forth. So in fact, I'm learning a lot from the treatments, successful treatments of multiple myeloma patients as to possible treatment for patients who have chronic fatigue syndrome. Many of those patients are benefiting, well, at least clinicians are using drugs like Biaxin.
Now, is that a VI or BI?
Biaxin, BI, B for boy.
Biaxin.
Biaxin.
Okay.
The longer name for it is clarithromycin. And again, it's just interesting that the tendency is to avoid, you know, to categorize drugs as being antibiotic and not this and that, but Biaxin or clarithromycin has a very defined mode of action in addition to it killing bacteria by inhibiting the cytokine chemokines.
Now, is that in any way related to erythromycin? Is it?
Oh, absolutely. You're right on target. They're basically a group of antibiotic called macrolides.
All right.
Which erythromycin is the number one example, and zithromycin is another, and so forth. These are the clinical studies. And we're just so short of resources and time, I mean, to do it. What I want to do specifically with this investigator at Cedars-Sinai is do a parallel observation of those patients' neurological and cognitive brain functioning, their mood. As I mentioned, the vast majority of patients who have multiple myeloma, when quizzed, will have symptoms of fatigue and loss of short-term memory and so forth. It's going to be a very important study to see if the treatments found effective to suppress the multiple myeloma component are going to benefit the patient's mental functions, mental status. If it does, that would be a strong encouragement to continue that line of treatment with adults with their chronic fatigue type syndromes, and hopefully, again, through appropriate clinical trials, get some of those treatment protocols evaluated in children who have these severe learning disorders, behavioral disorders, and so forth.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I did quite a bit of studying on chronic fatigue syndrome, and there's a wonderful book written by Hilary Johnson, not a medical book, but the story of this chronic fatigue syndrome called Osler's Web. I don't know if you're acquainted with it, but she mentioned that the group up in the Tahoe Incline Village area, at one time had a number of their patients on something called acyclovir, which was given intravenously, and really it was some sort of an antiviral disease, antiviral medicine, and the patients did miraculously well. I mean, people who had completely lost their ability to think and function had dramatic improvements, and then government seemed to do everything they could to block getting it authorized for public use, and eventually it just wasn't available at all here in the United States. Do you know anything at all about that drug or similar?
Well, I know about the drug, but I also know, because we've been involved in several reports to CDC and so forth, of outbreaks of illnesses occurring in communities. One was in Needles area of Eastern California and Western Arizona, Mojave Valley area, a very major outbreak that Dr. Anderson there identified. He reported it, but again, the response was so discouraging not to pick up on it. And I may have mentioned it in another radio program with you, a hairdresser in Jolton, Tennessee, where having lived in the community for a long time, she was aware that she was sick, a couple of her co-workers were sick, that there were people, her clients, were coming in with the same illness. She contacted the health department, and seemingly they had deputized her by asking if she knew of anybody else. She put an advertisement in the local paper, and over 100 people responded with a strange illness. But as soon as the mention came, well, it could be stealth viruses, could we started to culture, the CDC backed away and really expressed no interest in following these outbreaks. So there is, unfortunately, a sense of sneaking up upon us. All these illnesses that nobody is willing to take an overall view of it. We're concerned about bioterrorists causing damage and so forth. If somebody were to have predicted 10, 20 years ago that we have more than 10% of our children essentially unable to be educated because of their learning deficits and disorders and so forth, if they talked about the number of autistic kids that are coming, there would be an enormous, there should be an enormous response. What's going on? And yet, because it is isolated here and there, not brought to public attention, because people don't want to entertain the idea that there could be a virus epidemic occurring in the country because it might infringe on vaccine safety and so forth, seemingly we're blind to it. And the longer we let that thing slip by, it seems to me the bigger the problem will become.
Well, you know, the figures that we get from the people who are watching autism is there's been about a 600% increase, a 600% increase in the last 20 years. And, of course, this is just a disaster. I mean, these children, you know, are just totally incapable of functioning in society. A 600% increase, and nobody seems to be very interested.
Well, I can tell you, Stan, I mean, we've done the double-blind studies. We've done it as best we said, look, these autistic children are stealth virally infected.
They really are?
Yeah, and the answer comes back, basically to me personally, look, John, we'll include you in our pie, we'll give you a slice, we'll be good to you, and yet we want to keep our pie on the table, and I'm saying, no, you're missing the boat, you're missing the point. At the moment, there's this all hullabaloo about mercury causing autism and so forth, and it's such a crock. I mean, it's a shame, but it serves short-term political, economic purposes, but it doesn't help the patients. And if they'd only realize that it's not the mercury, it's what carries the mercury that is bad, and we can relate that back to these stealth viruses.
Well, now, are you suggesting, Chris, a lot of people have said that you know, these autism began after the MMR vaccine or certain other vaccines that were taken. Could there be stealth viruses in some of these other viruses besides the poliovirus?
No, I think, I mean, the answer could be, but again, just looking at things objectively and scientifically, there was a very good study done here in California where they looked at children who were to become autistic because at birth, we take a blood sample from all children to look for genetic diseases, PKU, and so the blood was available. And they could identify the vast majority of children who were going to become autistic had some chemical abnormalities in their blood at the time of birth. The difficulty was that the same abnormalities were occurring in children who went on to become mentally retarded. Instead of seeing a common cause that could go in different directions, people wanted to suppress that information or not take advantage of it, not use it in their reasoning. The argument that autism is present from birth, though, is pretty compelling. So the MMR vaccine can precipitate the illness. There's no doubt, and that's there. But to try to argue, as people did, that the MMR was contained the virus that was causing autism was, in my opinion, one of these scientific compromises that people tend to make, playing the same political game. Let's not put truth number one, let's put political expediency, what points can we make? The difficulty of that is that it's invariably going to backfire. The studies are not going to validate the claims that are being made. So instead of, again, looking at autism as a viral illness, and they will get it from their mother, because if you talk to the mothers of these autistic children, so many times there's the history of chronic fatigue in the mother. To basically look at it as a viral illness and begin to set up the appropriate clinical trials using drugs like, as you said, acyclovir and so forth, progress will be made.
Well, now, these studies that you're talking about, I've never even heard of this. Now, did they actually find evidence that the stealth virus was in these blood specimens of these children who later become autistic?
Yeah, no, the study that was done by representatives from the state of California with input from NIH was looking for chemicals that we associate with brain neurotransmission.
Okay.
The levels were elevated in the blood, I think it was even 90%, there were one or other abnormality detectable in the blood of the children who were to become autistic.
In other words, how long ago was this study done?
Oh, 2 years ago.
About 2 years ago, and basically then we were talking about an intrauterine infection.
Yeah, and people absolutely suppress pursuing that because it didn't fit in with the ease of argument of focusing on MMR vaccines and so forth. And what I find discouraging is the lack of open scientific debate, setting the limits to what can be talked about, not talked about, and so forth, instead of having scientists sit around a table and open discussion.
Well, now, of course, as far as the these specimens, were they checked for the stealth virus, or is it just that you've actually had an opportunity subsequently to check some of the children with stealth virus?
Yeah. I have checked a good number. We've done double-blind studies other people have actually done them. I've been done in the lab, but to keep it objective and have people doing it, we've taken a number of autistic children and compared them to normal blood donors, and you can distinguish the two groups very easily. I think it was something like 80% of the autistic children showed evidence of infection. Moreover, once we begin to take the label off these illnesses, you begin to see autism as part of a spectrum of illnesses that moves very quickly into the obsessive compulsive disorders, the behavioral problems, oppositional defiant behaviors, and the labels really obscure the fact that there's a spectrum of these illnesses rather than discrete illnesses totally unique to themselves and so forth.
In other words, you're saying the ADHD and autism and mental deficiency, all part of a spectrum of disease involving the brain?
And I think any parent with such a child would agree with that totally. It's the difficulty. I remembered some years ago presenting this viewpoint to a very prominent diagnostician for autism, and they said, gee, look, we're not very comfortable pursuing that line of reasoning, John. We're not molecular people. We're certainly not virologists. We're psychologists. What's in it for us? We'll just disclose our ignorance if we're going to start to look at this as a viral disease. And the other reaction I had was, look, John, you can't go anywhere with that because we wouldn't know how to manage these children in school if they were considered to be potentially infectious.
We're going to be back here in just 3 minutes. We've got a 3-minute break, Dr. Martin, and then we'll be back. We'll welcome your calls from across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're, of course, dependent upon those of you who listen to us and who believe that the information presented here is important to get out across America. If you believe that there's a problem and you'd like to become part of our effort to disseminate truth, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And of course, we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, why, it's simply the same number. We'd be glad to send you our June newsletter, which I think is certainly one of the most revealing letters we've ever written. And of course, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can get our newsletters there. You can get our archive programs. And as you know, we do 5 hours a day. Well, 3 hours a day are archived. So you can get the programs, afternoon and evening Radio Liberty programs are up there for perhaps 5 or 6 weeks, something of that sort. Anyway, we hope that you'll tell others about our radio programs. We hope you'll tell others about our website at radioliberty.com so that people living in other areas can listen to the internet programs and can get the news behind the news, the story behind the story, the information you're not going to get from the New York Times or the Washington Post, and certainly not from Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw. Because I would like to suggest that America really is under attack today. I believe that there are diseases out there, and we're a very, very conscious effort for one reason or another not to address them. If you haven't read that wonderful book, we don't carry it, but it's called Osler's Web by Hillary Johnson. And as you read this story, and it's the story of chronic fatigue syndrome, you get this horrible feeling that there are people within the highest levels of our government who have violated the mandates of Congress and instructions from our elected representatives, have taken the millions and millions of dollars appropriated to study chronic fatigue syndrome, and have done everything they could to waste that money on psychiatric conferences, doing everything they possibly can not to find the truth. And could this be possible? Well, as you know, we believe that behind all of the battles we face are spiritual element, and there really are people. Certainly go along with the system because they want to get ahead. But there are other people who have a different worldview than you and I. They are inherently evil. And whether you want to accept that or not, why, this is the explanation that I believe is explains so much of what's going on. Certainly, some people say, look, I don't want to rock the boat. And that's a very, very explainable situation. But others know what they're doing, and of course, continue doing it anyway. These are the people we saw working in the Nazi concentration camps in Germany. These are the people we see working certainly in the prisons in China and elsewhere, and some of the grotesque experiments that have been done there. Well, we're just about going to have to get back to the program. Again, remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is under attack today. Well, our guest this evening, Dr. John Martin, and Dr. Martin is both a physician and he's a clinician and, of course, a scientist, and he is a world-known retrovirologist and virologist and has been studying these diseases for a number of years and has written a number of papers on them. And you can certainly go to his website at www.ccid. That's the Center for Complex Infectious Disease.org. That's www.ccid.org or stealthviruses.com. And, of course, if you'd like to get in touch with him, would you want to give that email address just one more time?
Yes, Dan. CCIDLAB stan@hotmail.com. And you mentioned both those website addresses go to the same place, but it's stealthvirus.com.
Stealthvirus, not viruses. Okay, fine. Thank you so much. And, you know, the thing is that you've been, of course, trying to get people interested in this. If this indeed is an infectious disease, then we should be able to find someone of the drugs within the armamentarium that's growing to help it. Has anybody tried cyclovir on autism, or has it they tried this the erythromycin-like drugs on this?
Sure. Again, the acyclovir was tried. I think the difficulty has been that unless we link it to the presence of a virus and start to monitor the effect on levels of virus, then it's being given in the dark, as it were. They're difficult clinical trials. They take a lot of resources that need to be marshaled, I think, to do these clinical trials well. The limitation of acyclovir, at least among herpes viruses, is that it can be effective on some, but not others. As we get to those antiviral drugs that are more broadly active against herpes viruses, there's a potential toxicity. I'm encouraged, actually, by both the energy medicine approach that I mentioned to you, but also some of the herbal-type medicines that seem to be working along the same pathways as the biaxins and so forth, but probably have a less toxicity and so forth. But the research is just now making the transition from seeing what works well in the test tube to now really wanting to see it picked up by somebody and put into major clinical trials. Invariably, just to make a point, the proof of viruses or other bacteria causing diseases usually had to wait until somebody came up with a cure. That's the convincing bit of evidence that people want to see. Get rid of the infection, show me that the patient will get better. I think we have an enormous task ahead of us now, but the benefit is that these viruses do exist. It's no longer debatable. And as soon as that point will be accepted, then people will move on with the clinical trials. As soon as the clinical trials are done, the sooner we'll have a good indication of how to effectively treat these patients.
Now, did I understand you to say that 80% of the autistic children you've actually tested show signs of being infected with this stealth type of virus?
Oh, absolutely. No, there's no question, Stan, that that's a study that's been done, and the pattern fits into that. It just, as I said the last break, it's when people come back and say, we're not ready to go there yet. We wouldn't know what the implications are in terms of schooling of these children. What risk are teachers and special education put to if their children are going to be infected and so forth? Having one's head in the sand, as it were, is delaying, as I see it, an open debate based on hard data. That science should move separately from the political process. And then when all the scientific facts, then society can make a decision. To suppress the scientific exposure is a shame. And that's where, I see the system could be improved by not having radio programs on the radio as much as having open debates at places like CDC and so forth. But with each of the meetings that tend to come along, people set the agenda. There's a temptation now to have the person financing the meeting look in on the program, decide what can be presented, what can't be presented, what viewpoints are acceptable, and so forth. It's a shame.
Well, of course, this is entirely wrong. I mean, science is supposed to be impartial. It's not supposed to be subservient to who's putting the money up. And we're searching for the truth. At least that, theoretically, is what this should be. And unfortunately, things are very, very seldom the way they should be. And yet, we're looking at a major explosion of autistic children and children with, as Dr. Martin says, a serious learning disabilities that we never saw before. I mean, never anything like this. I have an article and I'm using in my latest newsletter, and simply a little article came out of the San Jose Mercury pointing out the literal explosion of diseases among our children, to the point where about 1 in 12 has a 1 in 12 children in America today has a serious disability of some sort, either learning disability or asthma or something else, and all of these things, this is an entirely different world than we had 30 or 40 years ago. Many of these are relatively new diseases or simply massive expansion of old diseases.
Well, again, look, it's almost like back and forth. I'm so aware of the social cost, and it doesn't take many mothers to call you and say, look, my daughter just suicided. She wrote in her suicide note that she wanted her body to go to chronic fatigue research. Are you interested in doing it, or can you help her out? And I'm saying to a grieving mother, no, we can't do anything. Better send me the note. And it's just so very sad to realize the social cost in terms of depression, mental illness, whether it's then leading to suicide, divorce, bankruptcy because people can't manage their financial affairs. There's an enormous tragedy out there that ought to be addressed scientifically rather than turning a blind eye to that or trying to ascribe all of these illnesses to violence on TV or access to guns and so forth. It's straightforward. It is, if you have an organic illness and a virus could be there, go and look for that virus and not be frightened by the fact that you might reveal something that is economically distasteful to pharmaceutical companies or other people who have vested interest in maintaining the status quo.
Well, now, one of the things you mentioned was that sometimes taking vaccines could precipitate this. Would this be because the vaccine would challenge the immune system to the point of view where the body then would be at least temporarily incapable of responding to the virus?
Well, actually slightly different, but it's a real good point. The way we look at these viruses is that they settle into the brain, they don't evoke this inflammatory immune response, and they just go along their way causing cells to compete with the resources of the cells, so the cells don't work well. It's almost better to have the immune system inactive rather than activating the immune system and then having it go along now and starting to wake up to the fact that these viruses are in the brain and causing damage. So the situation, as I see it, is that if we want to activate the immune system, if we want to activate these stealth viruses, and I should say one more thing, that if I have a viral growing in culture and I want it to grow faster, I can simply go to the local drugstore and not even get human vaccines. I can buy vaccines for animals, take those vaccine viruses and activate these stealth viruses. So I think that there is a way of aggravating these illnesses by pushing vaccines into somebody who's already stealth virally infected.
That is the most fascinating thing I've heard in a long time, and that would tend to explain why a lot of parents will say, my son was perfectly all right until they got their MMR vaccine, and then, my goodness, a couple of days later, they were immediately sick, and then suddenly they began to change and change dramatically.
We've had there was one lady particularly who child had sudden infant death syndrome, and she mentioned to me that she was so cautious during her pregnancy not to take medicines. And I said, why were you taking it? Well, for her chronic fatigue syndrome. She had some breast milk left in the refrigerator, and I could document not only that she was infected with a blood sample, but that her milk was transmitting these stealth viruses to her child. That's the type of child who shouldn't be vaccinated. What's the other extreme, though, is that you'll have a child who will have an adverse effect from the first vaccine, again, because doctors are not aware of all these complexities. The doctors will go ahead and recommend they have the second shot and the third shot, and predictably a bad reaction to the first shot and even more tragic reactions to later shots. So I think the argument of that vaccines may not be suitable for everybody can be made, and there should be some review of that general sense of let's not suggest that vaccines could be harmful for anybody. And it's not that vaccines are not doing good, but the reasonable compromise, they're good if you are healthy. They are probably not good if you have one of these stealth viruses.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Oh, just a comment, Stan. Again, thanks for the great program tonight. I just have one thing to say that maybe since I'm just a caller, maybe I can say this, whereas it might be inappropriate for you or your guest to say such a thing. I've been following your work for about 16 years now, and a lot of it has had to do with topics such as this. And I've just become convinced that as far as these government health institutions are concerned, some of which have been named tonight and others on other programs, the American population, I think, is nothing more than a giant petri dish to these people, where they get to perpetrate various things for experimentation, and then they go out and observe the results, and they go back to their laboratories and tinker with their formulations, and then they perpetrate some more things.
Well, certainly there are a lot of good people who work for government.
Right.
They
put up a great front, convincing us, the populace, that they're looking out for our best interests. After all, they just, they just want to take care of us.
All right,
that's
fine.
That's not quite the quote I'm looking for.
All right, fine. Well, let's get Dr. Martin's thoughts on that, because he's been on the front lines of this. He's worked at the FDA. He talks to these people. He goes to the CDC meetings. And, I've been to the CDC. There were some wonderful people there. There were some people there I'm really very worried about as well, that they had a different agenda. But let's get Dr. Martin's thoughts. Did you hear what Mike said? And what are your thoughts?
Absolutely. And I think you're right, Mike, though the focus is now let's do the studies overseas and kind of restrict doing a lot of work inside the United States, making clinical studies in the United States much more restrictive than those done overseas. And I think that one can look with some regret at the ease of doing studies in Africa and so forth and some of the consequences of what might have occurred in those studies compared to concerns in this country at the moment.
Yeah.
So I think most of the clinical trials in this country are pretty well regulated, good open disclosures and so forth.
Well, I'm glad for that because, I mean, I think that they've done some terrible things in years past, and now, of course, they're afraid that this will get out. Would that be a fair statement?
Testing hepatitis vaccines in early days to go into an orphanage and get fecal material from somebody who had hepatitis, mix it up and give it to the other children in the orphanage, was bad practice by anybody. Now, when that occurs in other countries, this country is very quick to criticize it, but that was the standard operating procedure in this country, early days of hepatitis vaccine.
Was that what Willowbrook Institution, there was a very famous case where they actually went into this orphanage and infected all these children just to see what would happen. It was just an incredible study. Anything else you want to say, Mike?
The overseas studies. I have to wonder, what are they studying? Possibly things, experiments or whatever, that might have begun 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, and they want to go back now and see what's become of their experiments.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks so much, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of things that have gone on in the past, and actually, I'm glad you reminded me of that experiment in the orphanage. I think that most Americans have never heard of that. But, of course, these things were done in the past by people who had... it was always done in the name of science, and that's really what bothers me. Science does not remove your humanity or your moral responsibility to your fellow human being. And that, of course, was that mentality that led to the Tuskegee study, which, of course, what was most frightening to me in that whole incredible story was that almost no one in the Centers for Disease Control or NIH saw anything wrong with recruiting 400 black men with syphilis and then withholding treatment for 40 years because it was done in the name of science. And that, of course, is unconscionable.
And the other one is in the name of national security. One of the hard questions for people to answer now is how were the studies conducted to evaluate potential of biological weapons and ways of protecting against biological weapons and so forth. Kind of, again, the sense is, well, you don't want to go there, John. That's a very sensitive topic and so forth. Perhaps people should go there, though, because it might provide clues as to how some of these stealth-adapted viruses developed and what might have occurred. So again, if scientists and the public are kind of running the show, there would be a much more open disclosure than, as it were, people somewhat hiding behind perhaps problems that could have been precipitated, perhaps in the best of intentions, but it would be nice to have really open disclosure about biological weapons programs that had existed. My own take on it now is that we're not confronting nations or terrorists, we're confronting nature, and I like to refer to this as nature's biological weapons program.
Yes, and but of course it would sound like this was introduced by man into our society, and now we've got it here, we've got to figure out what to do with it.
And also that nature, in all her powerful ways, is able to take that information or genetic material provided to her and can continue this process of rearranging it and coming up with new variants and so forth. So I think mankind has a major challenge on its hands to deal with the fact that atypical viruses exist. The word stealth or the description stealth virus is pretty appropriate to describe these. The indications now are that they can pass through bacteria. We can't eradicate bacteria from our environment. This could pose, and I think it does pose, an enormous challenge. And yet there's this somewhat complacent response, or let's not open up this topic now, let's wait. I think it would be far more prudent if our people running national health, public health authorities, were to be willing to take a very open look at all the available data and then disclose it to the scientific community and pull together as mankind should to try to protect the rest of mankind.
Well, of course, the biggest problem they ever had was when they started growing polio vaccine in the kidney tissue cultures from various types of monkeys, all of which had viruses, and they should have known that if the viruses were there, they were going to introduce them into the human species, into the entire human species. My concern is they're afraid for the public to learn the truth about what's happened in the past. And we know that Dr. Sabin was asked 20 years after it was found that the SV40, the cancer-producing virus, was in the original polio vaccine, you know, why they withheld the information. He said, well, of course, you know, the public would have been upset. Well, I think the public has a right to know, because we couldn't trust them then. What can we trust now? I think honesty is always the best policy, and that's one thing you learn as a physician. You make a mistake, tell the patient. Don't try to conceal it. And when you conceal it, the patient will never trust you again.
No, I agree. And again, I'm all for having counterbalances. And if the regulatory industry or regulators want to be biased towards industry, they need to be counterbalanced by having more public forum to take the public's viewpoint, number one. And then there's open debate, open discussion, and at least if the wrong decision is made, mankind can feel that they've done it responsibly.
Well, we've got Kurt calling in from Santa Cruz. We're almost out of time. Kurt, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, one question. question. Is candida possibly related to stealth viruses?
Is candida in any way related to stealth viruses?
Let me try and make the broader point. There are a number of illnesses out there, candida in the way of fungus, mycoplasma, borrelia, chlamydia for bacteria, and so forth. They are named known entities for which we know a lot about it. So if you're using the word candida in terms of talking about what people know to be this not very damaging type of fungus, then I would say that it has nothing to do with stealth viruses. On the other hand, if you ask me, can a stealth virus pick up some genetic information from candida, or could a stealth virus infect a candida to make it more virulent? Absolutely. I'd say that that's the type of thing that needs to be looked at. So the major issue is to recognize that organisms that we don't know enough about, that are atypically structured, exist, and not make the mistake of using a name for a known entity, whether it's candida, or as I said, mycoplasma, human herpes virus 6, even cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus. We know enough about those organisms to feel comfortable in what we're dealing with. We don't know enough about atypically structured stealth-adapted viruses. So I'm against the idea of using words like candida, very much in favor of saying that there are atypical organisms out there in the society, and we need to push very fast to understand how these organisms are structured, and in particular, why they don't evoke an immune response, how they do cause cell damage, and what can we do to marshal our resources to suppress those organisms.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much, Kurt. We're out of time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, Dr. Martin, I really want to thank you so much for being with us. The 2 hours flew by, and I will have to admit I've learned an awful lot this evening, and I hope our listeners have as well. Thank you, sir, very much for being with us.
As always, I enjoyed it very much.
Good night. God bless you, sir. Okay. Well, that was Dr. John Martin, who certainly has a tremendous wealth of information. And I want you to, in fact, if you'd like to find out about getting copies of these tapes this evening, let me suggest that I'm going to listen to this again. I hope that you will. In fact, this may well be a Tape of the Month Club selection, because so much of what was said tonight really is very, very, very profound. Dr. Martin, as I said, is an internationally known virologist and physician. We're so lucky to have had him with us. Well, this is the time when we have to say goodnight. Tomorrow morning we'll be doing a program at 10 o'clock. If you want to listen to it, it'll be on 10 o'clock, www.wxph.com. You can listen to it live streaming. And then, of course, we do another program on KKMC, our Saturday program, and you can hear that on www.kkmc. And so then we'll be off until Monday. Until then, may the Lord be with you.